Acts chapter 7, beginning with verse 17. This is in the midst of Stephen's address before the Sanhedrin. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and opposed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. At this time, Moses was born, and he was well-pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, your brethren, why do you wrong one another?" But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?" Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. When Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight. And as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him, saying, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses trembled and dared not look. Then the Lord said to him, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt." This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown them wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear." This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us, whom our fathers would not obey but rejected. And in their hearts they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, "Make us gods to go before us. As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to the idol, and rejoiced in the works of their hands. Then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets, "Did you offer me slaughtered animals and sacrifices during 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? You also took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god Remphan, images which you made to worship, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he appointed, instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern that he had seen, which our fathers, having received it in turn, also brought with Joshua into the land possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out before the face of our fathers until the days of David, who found favor before God and asked to find a dwelling for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. However, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands, as the prophet says, 'Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me?' says the Lord. Or what is the place of my rest? Has my hand not made all these things?" We'll stop there for now. May the Lord bless this reading to our hearts. You may be seated. Last week, I was so bold as to put the scripture passage in the bulletin as Acts 7, verses 1 through 60. We got through verse 16. This week, I've put Acts verse 17 through 60, and we'll see how far we get tonight. We may get through all of it. But we want to remember the context. We're partway through Stephen's address before the Sanhedrin. Now remember, the Sanhedrin is like the religious Supreme Court in Israel. And they have heard charges against Stephen. And they're found in chapter 6, verse 11, and chapter 6, verse 13. The specific charges are, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God. And then this man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place and the law. And so we see Moses and the law, Moses and the lawgiver are sort of one category there. This holy place is the temple. And it's all in relation, of course, to God. So the specific things that Stephen speaks of as he gives a sort of abbreviated history of Israel are touching especially on the issue of Moses and the law and on the temple. And what he is doing in his selective history lesson is bringing out ways in which their forefathers also rejected Moses, rejected the law, misunderstood the temple, just as his accusers are misunderstanding Jesus. And so this is both his address, it's his sermon, it's also his testimony against his accusers. Let's see where I left. Okay. Now, last time, there's four sections to the historical portion of his address and then a prophetic section at the end. So he's walking through history, and he starts with Abraham, Father Abraham, the great patriarch of Israel. And he has some verses dealing with Abraham in the patriarchal age. Then he moves forward to the time of Egypt and the exile and Joseph in Egypt, with Israel in Egypt. And now tonight we're going to get to the time of Moses and the Exodus, followed by the wilderness wandering. Then the next section is going to pick up a little bit from the wilderness into the conquest under Joshua and into the monarchy. He really picks up speed when he gets there. And if we get to it, there's a prophetic denunciation at the end of his speech. So we're picking it up here today with Moses. Let's see. So again, one of the charges against Stephen is we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses. And it may be in light of this charge that Stephen devotes by far most of his time in this address to dealing with Moses. If you compare it to the other figures and the other eras that he deals with, Abraham gets 7 verses, Joseph gets 8 verses, Moses gets 26 verses. And again, that probably has to do with the fact that he's specifically charged with speaking blasphemous words against Moses. And he treats the life of Moses in 3 40-year periods. And the first period is in verses 17 through 22. Now, we've read them. You can look at your text. I'm not going to reread everything that we've read already. I'm going to highlight some selected verses here. First of all, verse 17, "But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham." Now, we saw Abraham back in the very first section, and we know that Abraham was the one with whom God made his covenant and gave his covenant promises, including the promise of a land and the promise that from him a great nation would arise, and ultimately from him and through his seed a redeemer would arise. And the Jews were always looking back to Abraham the patriarch. But the way this is worded, "when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham," shows God's sovereignty at work here. The time of the promise has drawn near. It is the time in which God is going to begin to fulfill those promises. Now I'm just going to skip down to verse 22. We have a little bit of an account there of Moses' birth and how he was raised in the household of the Egyptians. We read in verse 22, "And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds." Stephen's description of Moses as mighty in words and deeds foreshadows Jesus. Luke, the author of Acts, has described Jesus as mighty in deed and word in his gospel in Luke 24:19. And we know that Luke presents Jesus as a second Moses, as that prophet like Moses who was prophesied. And so we're going to see every once in a while these little connections between Moses and Jesus. So we have that first 40-year period of his life up until the time that he has grown up in Pharaoh's household and has gained the knowledge of his education among the Egyptians. Then there's a second 40-year period, in verses 23 through 29. We read in 23, "Now when Moses was 40 years old, it came in his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." And this word "visit" is important here. Dennis Johnson, one of the commentators, writes, "The word visit is significant, meaning not just go to spend time with someone, but also intervene on behalf of someone. Moses expected his brothers to see in his visit, especially in his defending a mistreated Israelite from an Egyptian oppressor, the beginning of the Lord's redemptive visitation to rescue his people, but they did not." And you know what happened. Moses went among his people. He saw one being mistreated by an Egyptian. He killed that Egyptian, and he thought that was actually going to spark a revolution. He thought that was going to inspire the Israelites to follow him. But far from it, the Israelites pointed it out to him and basically let him be known that word had spread. Well, Moses' life wouldn't be worth much in Egypt. This one who was treated as by favor among the Egyptians, if he was known to have killed an Egyptian, certainly he would have received the death penalty. And so we read in verse 29, "Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons." And all of that's encompassing a second 40-year period. Then in verse 30 we read, "And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai." And again, I'm going to quote Johnson, "In that strange setting, far from the site where the temple would be built, an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush." And this is one of those subtle things that Stephen is doing in his message here. His accusers have such a high view of the temple. They think the temple is the only place where God dwells. The temple is the only place where God meets with his people. And one of the things Stephen does in this address is highlight times where God appeared to his people away from the temple. And so Johnson writes, "In that strange setting, far from the site where the temple would be built, an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush." Just giving them the idea that they need to think beyond the categories of the local temple. Then verse 33, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground.'" And again, the Jews in Stephen's day thought the holy ground was in Jerusalem. It was the holy city. The temple was the holy place. The holy of holies within the temple was the holiest place. That was their understanding of sacred geography. And yet Stephen is reminding them that when the Lord spoke to Moses from the burning bush, that was holy ground. And interpretation along those lines is traced all the way back to Chrysostom in the early church. John Stott quotes him, "The holy ground at the burning bush was far more wonderful than the holy of holies, for God is nowhere said to have appeared in the inner sanctuary in Jerusalem as he did in the burning bush. So the lesson to learn from the experience of Moses is that God is everywhere present and that the holy place is there wherever God may be." You know, when Jesus came and spoke to the Samaritan woman, he said, "A day is coming when you'll worship neither in Jerusalem nor in Samaria." There was a universalization of the place of worship that came with the new covenant that Jesus brought in. That's why we don't have to go to the temple in Jerusalem for special pilgrimages or anything like that. Looking down at verse 35, "This Moses whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. Now he speaks here about wonders and signs in the land of Egypt. And again, that recalls what Peter has already said about Jesus in his great message on the day of Pentecost. We read back in Acts chapter 2, starting at verse 22, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death." So he is calling for his listeners to go back to the time of Moses and to remind them that there was a time when Israel rejected Moses. Who made you a ruler and a judge? Even though he had brought them out through the Exodus from Egypt. This Moses, whom they rejected. And what is the problem with the Sanhedrin and those who are like them? They're rejecting someone else, aren't they? They're rejecting Jesus. And so Stephen is drawing a connection there. Just as our fathers were wrong to reject Moses, who was sent by God, the implication is you are wrong to reject the one who also was sent by God. Be careful whom you reject, he's implying. Verse 37, this is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren, him you shall hear. Now Peter, back in Acts chapter 3, has already preached that Jesus is the fulfillment of this prophecy. Jesus is the prophet like Moses whom God had promised to raise up. And so he's sort of dangling the question out there, how can it be that he is blaspheming against Moses when he's proclaiming that God is fulfilling the prophecy given to Moses? Far from speaking down about Moses, he is showing how God has been faithful to what he did through Moses. And then again in verse 39, he says of Moses, whom our fathers would not obey but rejected. And there's that, again, that message to his accusers. Be careful whom you reject. There was a time when our fathers rejected the great Moses. Be careful whom you reject. And then in verses 40 through 43, Stephen quotes from the book of Amos to show that the pattern begun in the wilderness, Israel sacrificed not to the Lord but to his rivals, Molech, Rephan, and others, continued in the land of promise, from which the Lord eventually sent Judah into exile beyond Babylon. If you look at those verses, you also took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your god Remphan, images which you made to worship, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. They rejected Moses, and in rejecting Moses and in rejecting the law, they joined with the pagan worship that had existed in the land prior to their arrival. So that covers the time of Moses, and again, that's the greatest portion of the message because it directly addresses one of the charges against him. Now we get to speed it up history that's going to start from that wilderness, move into Joshua's conquest in the promised land, and quickly shift over to the monarchy when David is reigning on the throne. Now, remember, one of the charges against Stephen is that this man does not cease to speak blasphemous words against this holy place. After dealing with the objection about Moses, Stephen shifts to address the objection about the holy place by tracing its transition from the tabernacle to the temple. And so we begin reading in verse 44, "Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he appointed, instructing Moses to make it according to the pattern that he had seen." Now, he has just really completed his long section about Moses, and the mention of Moses here sort of links what is about to come with what went before, and there's another linkage in that is here, because just before this, he had spoken of the tabernacle of Moloch, and now that is contrasted with the tabernacle of witness. The tabernacle of witness was that which Moses had constructed in the wilderness according to the divine pattern. That was the place that God had set aside. They weren't to be worshiping Moloch in his tabernacle. They were to be worshiping Yahweh in his. And it was called the tent of testimony, the tent of witness, because it contained within the Ark of the Covenant the tablets that God gave Moses on Mount Sinai that bore witness to his exclusive covenant relationship with the people of Israel. It was only to Israel that he gave his law. It was only with Israel that he made his covenant. But from that brief mention of the wilderness, we move onward. Verse 45, "Which our fathers, having received it," that is, having received the tabernacle, "in turn, also brought with Joshua into the land possessed by the Gentiles, whom God drove out before the face of our fathers." So the tabernacle was with God's people when they took possession of the nations whom God had driven out before the face of the fathers. And in this manner, God fulfilled his promise to Abraham that Israel shall come out and worship me in this place. That was mentioned earlier in the section on Abraham in verse 7. This is quoting from the Old Testament. And the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, said God. And after that, they shall come out and serve me in this place. Now, that was spoken to Abram in the land of Canaan. And now, under the conquest, they have entered the land of Canaan to fulfill the promise that God made about it. And from the conquest, again, just a brief mention, we come reading on until the days of David, who found favor before God and asked to find a dwelling for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. Now, Stephen has spoken positively about the tabernacle of witness. He's not spoken down about the tabernacle. He doesn't really speak down about the temple as well. We're told that David found favor before God. He sought a dwelling place for the God of Jacob. But was David allowed to build the temple? Anybody remember why David was not allowed to build the temple? He was a man of war. He was a man of blood. And with that blood on his hands, it was not appropriate for him to be the one to build the temple. But the Lord didn't scrap his idea of a temple. He merely reassigned it to his son Solomon. And David actually did some preparatory work in gathering supplies and making plans that Solomon then carried out in the building of the temple. But remember, he's spoken blasphemous words against this holy place being the temple. This, of course, being the second temple that was built after the exile. But we read on, starting in verse 48. However, the Most High does not dwell in temples made with hands, as the prophet says, "Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Has my hand not made all these things?" Now here, Stephen is quoting from the prophet Isaiah, who's speaking about God. And God says, "Heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What house will you build for me?" In other words, I'm so large, I'm so big that I can't fit in any kind of house that you can make. And this was something that Solomon recognized even as when the temple was built. We read in 1 Kings 8:27, this is during the dedication of the temple after it's completed. Solomon says, "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you, how much less this temple which I have built." So the Sanhedrin and the Jews of their day are treating the temple before them in Jerusalem almost like the pagans treat their temples. You know, the pagans had temples and their gods actually dwelled within them because their gods were idols. They were statues of wood or of stone or of metal. And that was the place that God lived. And that was the only place that God really lived. And they could go see it and they could touch it. But this temple was not a place that held an idol. For this was the temple of Yahweh, the God of Israel, who is so great that he cannot be contained in such a house. And so here again, in light of the accusation against him, there's a subtle message that Stephen is sending to his accusers. Beware if your attitude toward the temple is more pagan than it is Jewish, than it is in line with what God has revealed. I think I'll stop there tonight because the next two sections go together pretty well and we can have our prayer time. That finishes the historical part of Stephen's address. He's spoken about all these ages. He's ended up with the time of the monarchy, and he's even quoted the prophets during that time. And what's going to happen next is he's going to close with an actual denunciation of his accusers, and then the aftermath of that, you well know, is the stoning of Stephen. So we'll pick that up in several weeks when we get back, but I think we'll stop here so that we can deal with those two sections together. Let's mark here.